That's a tricky part. Stupid.
I wrote something. Wrote One Roof yesterday. I was like,
it is so easy to write blues.
It really is.
Oh my god, that dude, that took no brain power to write that.
It is pretty easy.
That took no fucking brain power.
Pentatonic and blues is just like common sense.
Like, but I found some fucking dude. Real quick. Take into consideration you love tremolo picking the top three strings. I don't know why I don't listen to rockabilly. That's what it's all
I
about.
I like rockabilly. Just a lot of it is shit.
A lot of it is shit. Yeah. You gotta find the right stuff. Man, dude, Reverend Horton, he's a fucking man.
All right, well, this is Cracks in the Wall, podcast episode number 4. This is S. Wilner and Justin Roberts, and just waxing intellectual about random concepts like how my... my hemorrhoid doesn't seem to be the natural type of hemorrhoid it seems to be.
Yeah, you're saying it was something like it's not a traditional hemorrhoid?
It's not a traditional hemorrhoid. It's I was trying to check it out in the mirror and it didn't look like it was... Well, a hemorrhoid is just like a blood vessel that's coming out of the anal cavity. This one looks like it's right on the ridge of the taint and the anus wall. And it's not extruding. It seems to be... I don't know. It might be an internal one, but it fucking hurts like hell. And it's just from sitting down all the time. If I'm walking around, it goes away. Like when we were walking around in St. Augustine, it went away in a few days.
See, the weird thing is, I'm the direct opposite. The two times that I've ever had hemorrhoids was from a job where I stood all day in a warehouse, hot warehouse setting. Mm-hmm. So,
do you think being full of shit is basically what you get? You get a hemorrhoid for being full of shit. Is that...
Well, you're full of shit because you only shit once a day. Oh. Compared to me, I do it 3 times a day.
It's really bad when you shit only once a day. I don't enjoy the fact
that's
that
not good.
I don't enjoy that I only get one shit a day. You get like 9.
A certain person we know who's I won't say their name, but their name is spelled B-I-L-L-C.
Right. Okay.
And he only shits once every 3 days or something.
No, he was that's exaggerating. He embellishes just about everything.
That's pretty fucking scary, though. Mm-hmm. That's something, yeah, I wouldn't be able to deal with that.
No.
So basically, I'm shitting 9 times as much as him in the same span of time.
Right,
that's
right.
That's crazy.
But, I mean, it must be good because you get that kind of empty feeling and, like, your body is purified of toxins and you could just keep consuming and not have to worry about being over-encumbered by gaining weight or anything, right?
Yeah.
It's the opposite when you're, like, constipated. It's horrible.
Well, it's like, for men, well, I guess, I don't know if women, when they come, but, like, men, especially, obviously, because of that I know about, it's a relief. And I wonder what the age is where the sort of relief you get from taking a shit overtakes the relief you get from ejaculating.
Because
I know, like, your ejaculation pleasure, the physical pleasure kind of diminishes with time. Unless you do those, like, Kegel exercises or whatever. But, I've talked...
Are you talking about for men? Or for,
yeah, I'm talking
for
about for men.
Or for both?
Talk about for men. Oh, okay. Women's libidos, like, don't decline until they're, like, 50. But right. Men, like, start to decline when they're about 35 or so. But, I just wonder, like, what is it like to, like, enjoy shitting more than ejaculating? It's strange.
It might be just considered a blessing to take a piss and not have it feel like razors, or to be straining when you get to a certain age and your prostate's enlarged. That's got to be one of the most painful things ever. I remember going to the mall with my grandpa when he was getting on in years, when he was like in his 60s, something like that. And I would just take a piss next to him, and he would just have to stand there for like 10, 15 minutes longer than me. And it looked like the most unbelievably painful situations when your prostate enlarges to that point.
Yeah, just another sign that people aren't meant to get that old.
Yeah, well,
civilization.
Well, that brings us back to what we were talking about, sort of the extreme left-hand path and the what I was describing as the Death Star Merkaba, and sort of some of the reasoning.
Can you
fill
me in on what Merkaba means? Because I'm ignorant as to what that means.
It's a type of sacred geometry that's used by New Agers to try to basically open up corridors and ascend and promote harmony and healing. And it's just based on balance and symmetry and,
okay,
you know, cosmic harmony and vibration. And it has a lot to do with music, actually. You know, the symbols correspond to musical tones that are what you would call healing or just, I don't know. A lot of it is mumbo-jumbo. I'll have to give you that.
Yeah.
But what I was saying is one of the reasons that I think this world is... Basically, what I was saying is human beings right now are as dead as they're ever going to be, in my opinion. I feel like this Earth and this, in particular, our solar system is probably a really extreme case of being unnatural on the overall cosmos. And I think it's because we're ensnared by these extreme left-hand path beings who at one time or at one point in their history were facing extinction via a black hole or some way that their star matter was going to basically collapse and their world was going to collapse. And they were so scientifically advanced and so, I don't know, magically advanced, that it would seem magical to us anyway, that they basically needed to thrive and to feed off of other living universes and other living worlds and entities even, a.k.a. the Matrix, where they were basically using humans as batteries to prevent themselves from returning to space dust. And I feel like that's why Earth is a prison planet. That's why we have the majority of suffering and depression that we do, is because there are unseen forces that are almost like the Gnostic Archon that are feeding off of our essence parasitically and holding us here. And I feel like on the one hand, it seems like it could be temporary and that at one point human beings could break free from that. But at the other end of the spectrum, there's just complete annihilation and ending back into nothingness and actually being consumed as a food source. You know, I'm not sure about the spiritual hierarchies, but certainly in the physical body, it feels like we're enshackled by them a little bit. And I know you think that I have a lot of woo-woo ideas, so I'd like to hear your point of view as far as the left-hand path, middle path, and right path, and why you think human beings suffer as much as they do, and maybe get into some of your personal suffering.
Well, first of all, just like to find the term left-hand, middle, and right. These are very loose terms. It has to do with occultism and metaphysical ideas in the Western Occidental tradition, even though a lot of the Occidental occultism came from the East. So, first of all, I want to say that I'm a big fan of Occam's Razor. I like it a lot. So, as to what you said about basically us being in a contrived matrix to where we are being used for whatever energies we give off, it's certainly an interesting idea, and a lot of people have that idea, and it's understandable, but it's kind of strange. I know it's kind of paradoxical, but I'm a solipsist at the same time that I believe in Occam's Razor. Actually, maybe that's not so paradoxical, but basically, the best way I could say is that, like Einstein said, reality is simply an illusion, albeit a very persistent one. So, because I am a Kantian Schopenhauerian, basically, for lack of a better description, I believe that the phenomenal in the nominal world is, I take it for what it is via the way that the human mind is simply a down-regulating system. The human mind only really takes in that which is suitable or necessary for it to survive in the phenomenological world. And any other sort of superfluous or extra, I don't know what you would say, extra utilitarian ideas or perceptions are simply a byproduct of the senses that we already have that are necessary for us to live as creatures on this planet.
Certainly you have toyed with the idea of the Archon in your past, or the concept that there's a trickster god, or an omniscient being that not necessarily doesn't care about us, but through the law of natural order has to let parasitic entities be parasites. And if we were as a species, as a sentient species on this Earth, caught up in that kind of snare, it would seem like we were, you know, doomed to that kind of finalism, and we wouldn't have any leeway or breathing room to better ourselves or to ascend away from our captors. I don't really feel like it's a closed system, like a matrix, like you were saying, like they throw a net over this world and control it, control a natural universe that was in one point, you know, in harmony, where human beings had more access to what people would call the Akashic Records, had more abilities with their consciousness to communicate with one another, and weren't plagued as much as we are. And I know a lot of our pain and suffering grounds us, and it's very important. But at the same time, you know, many people feel like there's an external source that is completely out of our league as far as escaping their clutches. Like I was giving the analogy to Star Wars and the Death Star. Many of the researchers in the APC, the Alternative Perception Community, get into some pretty insane stuff. I mean, like David Icke is famous for the reptilian agenda and that kind of thing. He just came out with a new book where he's talking about how the moon itself is basically beaming this matrix reality over our planet. You ever see the movie They Live?
Yeah.
He was basically saying that that movie was pretty much dead on, except the broadcast signal is coming from our moon, our Luna, or whatever. And in that movie They Live, when the main character gets the sunglasses or goggles and he starts looking at Pepsi logos or, you know, Coca-Cola ads or things on the billboards, they said, stay asleep, obey, you know, obey authority, that kind of thing. That's what they said. That's what the coding before the Matrix was overlaid, the hologram that was being beamed from in the film, was the top of, like, the Chrysler building or something like that.
And, yeah, it's been a while since I've seen it.
Anyway, Icke's theory and a lot of other theories when it comes to reptilians, it's not necessarily talking about literal reptilians. What the reptilian agenda is basically a group of ascended masters or ETs that were facing the choice between left-hand path, right-hand path, or as you were talking about earlier, what I'd like you to get into again is the middle path, and who chose the extreme left-hand path because they had the technology to avoid their own extermination. They chose to feed off living systems, aka Earth, to basically sustain their parallel universe from being destroyed. And, you know, that's very sci-fi, but it's sometimes you have to go to those unbelievable, unimaginable realms to describe the kind of depression and suffering that we experience on a daily basis. But it may just be a circumstance of evolution and of being completely unnatural. Like we were talking about before, a tree just is a tree. Even lower animals like dogs and our pets and those kinds of things, they just are themselves. They don't, you know, Seamus, your dog who's getting older now, who's having really bad problems with his hips, he doesn't have a whole lot of affect or emotional ability to convey the pain that he's in. He just is. And it's curious. What do you think that as a dog, how he experiences pain, that he has no idea, you know, about the finality of his life, but certainly when he sees Muggs, which is the newer puppy, jumping around and being more vital and having all this energy and biting him and nipping him around, and he must realize on some level that he's no longer able to compete with that, or he's like a different entity to that he once was, or maybe not, or maybe he doesn't even have that much of a realization.
I don't think he would. Yeah, I don't. I think basically, when it comes to, I mean, you know, I love dogs. You know, I think they're fucking great, but they're not too bright compared to many animals, especially like there's certain like birds of the corded. I don't know if it's the phylum. I forget. I haven't done biology since 10th grade. But there are certain birds that are smarter than dogs. So I don't really think that he has that enough of an abstract reasoning to really understand that this animal, Muggs, the puppy, compared to him, is more vital, is more physically virile and vigorous. I think basically, even though the dog, Seamus, the older dog, has been degenerating, he's got hip dysplasia, which is common amongst large dogs, I don't really think he takes it into consideration. I think he just, like, suffers moment to moment, which is, that sucks, but at the same time, they don't, like I said, have that abstract reasoning where they say, I am suffering. So there's a little bit less of a suffering going on. There's not the deep psychological component that humans have. And as far as his recognition of the puppy Mugs vis-a-vis his, you know, compared to his abilities, I guess you could say, that's probably just something akin to very basic chemical relationships or chemical reactions that dictate the relationships of intra-species conduct and interaction. It's like the same thing like where milk has opioids in it, or at least chemicals that adhere to the opioid receptors in the brain. And basically the theory is that evolutionarily it basically makes it so that the child is more fond of the mother. So when it takes in the mother's milk, there's a rush of opiate-like sensation. And anybody who knows, like, you know, eats a lot of chocolate and drinks a big glass of milk knows all about that.
And you were not breastfed as a child, right?
No, I wasn't, unfortunately.
I was. I'm not sure how long my mother breastfed me, but I believe it was for quite some time. I had a lot of mother bonding at a very young age. I think that we were talking about, like, babies that are born via C-section, natural birth, drugs or without drugs. Even babies today, a lot of, more spiritually aware people are having, home births, that kind of thing. They're basically birthing their children in the waters and having a nurse present or something like that. And the theory is that the baby basically starts to breathe on its own without being forced into a hostile environment with a bunch of lights and that kind of thing, that it will have a less traumatized experience its first hours. And also, you were telling me that that your immune system is boosted quite a bit if you're birthed naturally.
Yeah, it's strange. There's a correlation between not only the immune system, but especially allergies. They did a recent study, and I don't remember where and when, but it's certainly a peer-reviewed study. It's good in foundation and science. But basically what they said was, if you are birthed naturally, obviously, we all know what that is, you, for some reason, you accumulate bacteria, I guess, in the vaginal walls or something like that, because, you know, the vagina is, like, real good.
Like a culture, yeah.
Yeah, like a culture. You take all that in, and apparently it boosts your immune system, and it makes you less liable to get allergies. Because all allergies is just like a pathetic attempt of your body to expel what it thinks is antibodies. And then also the same thing with... And it also, they say that if you're born via C-section, it's not so good for the brain of the baby, nor is it good for the overall mental health, because it's far more traumatizing to be taken out that way rather than going through the vagina or
right.
The uterus, whatever. I don't know what the technical term is.
Right.
You know, I watch porn. But... and also, real quick, breast milk is really good. That boosts the IQ as well, and does a whole lot of good things for babies. And because I was on formula, I'm probably about 10 or 15 points of IQ stupider than I would have been. So that puts me at about 69. And because 69 is such a great number, I'm not too mad about it.
Yeah. I know, but you are definitely a little bit self-denigrating when it comes to your intelligence and what you're able to create
but
musically and things like that. Well, it's a good point.
It's because I'm egoistic. Come on.
Okay, but you're also nihilistic, and you also kind of loathe the idea of the ego, even though it's, basically organic and it's just a part of our processes. But what we were talking about before, how that's what I wanted to get into with this. Justin's facing sort of a crossroads right now, because he's had basically albums and albums worth of this just, in my opinion, fantastically organized and intelligently written harmonic psychedelic type music with all kinds of inspirations that are from bands that are just genius, like King Crimson and a lot of prog bands in the 70s. And a lot of your...
Oh, don't forget, like, DRI, too.
Yeah, DRI,
I
exactly.
I like fucking punk.
And then you have the inspiration from the black metal days as well, which
absolutely
gives you a really strange spin on some of the prog rock that you play and the psychedelic rock, because you have that intense love for... Or at one time, you had the intense inspiration from black metal, which is just, like, a combination that you just never see guitar players really utilizing. Maybe you know, in my opinion, I've never heard a band that has the kind of influences that we have all wrapped together in some kind of new genre of music.
I think that's why I'm so fucked up.
Yeah, but you've also kind of put this parameter of happy, like, in order for your happiness to sustain itself, you have to physically, tangibly have a recording of all the music that you've had pent up for years and years and years. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what it's like to have, in my opinion, genius-level music that's never been actualized and put onto disc, and why you feel there's no way you could be happy or just live a normal life, as you know, we see people doing every day, without achieving this album that you want to create, and why you think it's mandatory, even though you have nihilistic ideals as well.
Wow, is that a loaded question?
I know, I'm sorry.
That's all right. I'm not going to go exactly in order. First of all, I would never attribute the word genius, and I know you kind of use it loosely, to anybody in music other than Bach, Beethoven, maybe Mozart, you know, like the real freaking genius.
Maybe that's part of the problem, is I inflate people like that are close to me. Maybe that's part of the...
Well, no, I mean, we have very similar interests, yeah. So of course, naturally, I'm going to rather listen to you. I would rather listen to you canoodle on the guitar.
Well, you said the same thing about my metal project, Vixis, and I have. Yeah. I don't feel like it's extraordinary in very many ways. Like, I wouldn't say
well,
that.
What
it's
is? I mean, nothing is new under the sun.
That's what I'm saying.
But at the same time,
especially in Western music, you know.
We have differing opinions on that, and that's a whole different topic.
Okay, instead of getting on a major tangent, I'll let you just explain the last point, because it was loaded, right?
What else did you ask? Because I had a few shots.
The crux of it,
the crux of it is
you're giving yourself a time frame of 6 months to record this album, that you have songs and songs worth in your head. I'm just wondering why it would be so hard for you to surrender that part of your personality and say, fuck all this, I can just move on and be Justin and not have to attach this musical identity and all the songs I've written to my happiness, to my being. Why is that?
That's because I'm an all-or-nothing person, unfortunately. It's like H.L. Mencken said, somebody asked him, why do you write so prolifically? And he says, why do hens lay eggs? And I try to attribute my musical yearnings to, like, taking a shit. Like, I feel like I have a big shit stirring into my stomach, and I gotta shit it out. And it's this audio fecal matter that is eventually gonna be the product. And I also, in my sentimental heart of hearts, hope that other people would be influenced, or not influenced, but inspired, really, actually, to be honest, by the music. And ever since I was a little kid, I've always gotten these, like, epiphanic sort of moments where I feel that I transcend my humanness. I transcend all circumstances that the human would know. I go well beyond logic. I've done plenty of psychedelics and salvia. And, I don't want to talk about salvia. Psychedelics, anyway. And this goes far beyond that. I don't believe in transcendence. I'm a as above, so below kind of guy. But it certainly feels that way. And the vast majority of time that I felt this was listening, and I'm not even on drugs, although drugs does facilitate the enjoyment of music. But not even on drugs, there's times where, like, if the wind blows in the right direction and you're walking through the right set of woods and you're listening to the right song, I mean, fucking sex doesn't even compare to it, you know? It's like the ultimate drug. So I have that reinforcement. Plus, there's an egoistic part of me that needs to get it out. I feel also that I've been enjoying all this music by all these great musicians who have given me great pleasure over the years, and I feel that I have to return that. Like, for lack of a better term, using this as a very, like, kind of like a poetic way, but I believe that the gods are telling me that I need to create music, whether it's crap or not.
So,
and you also said, why can't I live a normal life? I could put in psychiatric terms, I got a lot of different comorbid, fucked up things going on in my brain.
Okay, well, that's a pretty broad answer, but it definitely touches on a lot of the things that I was trying to get at. Basically, maybe talk a little bit, since we're talking to an audience that doesn't really know you nearly as well as I do, like, maybe talk about what you think of as the finality of life and your views on the afterlife and your view, in one sense, if nothing matters, you know, if you were saying it's better than sex, it's sort of like that kundalini energy that's rising that you experience while writing the music sometimes, or listening to music that's just incredible to you. You know, you experience those moments in the now, whether or not you record it or not. And if in your mindset, if it doesn't matter, because when we die, we just there is nothing. It's just absolute, you know, absence of being. Then what is the importance of, like, carrying on a legacy, like inspiring other musicians, or, you know, like what, when we listen to a Jimi Hendrix album or something like that, and we're just like, that guy didn't have to try to be a prodigy, to be, you know, that sort of personification of cool and just organic flow, you know, fireworks from his guitar. Like, that has inspired thousands and thousands of artists and has created sort of trends in music that would never have existed if he had not. And I wonder why you think that matters if at the point of death it's just blankness. You know what I'm saying?
First of all, I would say, is it just kind of a glib general answer? What the hell else am I going to do with my life? But to get, like, further into it, Jimi Hendrix, I read a quote by him. He said that what he really wants to do with his music is just inspire people just to do shit, get up and live fucking life. And he also said, fly your freak flag high. And I like that.
Well, wouldn't that presume that you have a love for humanity at some level?
I have, yeah. Oh yeah. Well, on a mechanist reductionist level, there's chemicals in my brain that makes it so I do care about humanity on a certain level, even though I am absolutely disgusted by being a redundant pile of fucking protoplasm. And that has a lot to do with it. It's basically, like, I look at myself. I'm not particularly attractive, I don't think, anyway. Although I'm not ugly. I don't really talk well with most people. Like, I have very limited views, or not limited views, but limited interests. So I'm not sort of able to, like, mingle with the oi polloi. And I'm also, I don't know, I have very, you know, psychology and shit like that, art. That's the shit I'm interested in. And a lot of people really aren't. They're more interested in what's on television or which sports team won what game.
You could say that, yeah, I would lump you in the category of a seer, sort of Don Juan's sorcerer that basically sees through to the point of reality that...
That's true. I definitely have what what Friedrich Nietzsche, I call him Nietzsche, I'm sorry, because that's the Polish... said, I've stared into the void, you know, like I said, I've done psychedelics, but even outside of psychedelics, I've experienced the void. I've experienced psychosis that has nothing to do with drug, you know, it wasn't drug-induced psychosis. I have experienced things that are hyper-real and hypo-real, you know, the whole gamut of human experience, whatever the brain can take in as far as metacognition and metaphysics, I've pretty much experienced it. And taking that into consideration, I really like to stimulate myself and just be mind-bending. It's kind of like back in the 60s, man, like where people were taking loads of psychedelics and blowing each other's minds. That's my favorite thing in the world. And if I could blow other people's minds, like, you know, and disillusion them from and disabuse them from their everyday reality, that would be, like, the greatest thing in the world. I don't want to make a value judgment like I'm a seer, though.
Doesn't it seem like an overwhelming amount of odds stacked against you? Since
yes.
The majority of people are just more than happy to sit down and watch fucking Britney Spears on TV and, you know, mindless e-reality television shows and
Absolutely.
Be obsessed with materialism and that kind of thing. And so I guess you feel your music is one way to gigantically punch these fuckers in the stomach and
yeah, those people I really do want to, like, I despise them simply because I can't enjoy the happiness that they can. I am not lucky enough to be able to believe in any sort of religion. I'm not lucky enough to be able to be devoid of any, like, self-consciousness to the point where I can just mingle with anybody and be, you know, a big extrovert and, you know, the life of the party. Because I'm an egoist with low self-esteem, I have other ways of sort of being able to realize my will, and that's through music, I guess. And, yeah, I do want to... First of all, I think the best way to educate people is not by telling them what to do, but by disillusioning their beliefs. I think that when you bring it down to the core of reality, or whatever you want to call it, the very basics of a phenomenal world, that is the best way for people to learn. When you tell them stuff, they're kind of like putting it together, but they're not putting it together themselves. They're not going through all the machinations in their brain to where it would be a substantial realization on their own. So people who are teachers or cultists, not occultists, but cult leaders, I think they're the biggest fucking assholes in the world. I mean, I think it's funny that they take people for, you know, all they're worth, but they're perverts in every sense of the term. I don't want anybody, like, if I were to be a teacher, I would never want anybody to take my fucking opinions wholesale. That would be the worst thing that they could do. That would be, basically, that would mean I failed as a teacher. What I want is, and I know it's a cliche, but most people don't believe this, but I do believe this, is I want people to think for them fucking selves and not judge based on consensus reality, which is like, you know, I don't remember who it was, but they said 90% of our experience is in our own minds, and 10% is what we would call consensus reality. And that 90%, which makes up the most of us, the most of our experiences in the world, in everyday life, nobody knows about. That world dies. When you die as an organism, the entire world of the aesthetic tastes, all those incredible impressions, the epiphanies that you have, the hatreds that you have, the loves that you have, all the orgasms or the shovels to the face, that shit dies with you. Yeah, okay, a few people might tell a story, but it'll only be a perverted approximation of what you actually were.
An aggrandizement or a drama or just a reenactment that gets it horribly, horribly
yeah,
wrong.
Yeah, but basically, yeah, just you're right, just getting it wrong. It's not accurate at all. And it would be asking too much to get it accurate. So the best thing we can do, as far as I'm concerned, is, and it's I know it's a gay, overused song, but I like the song anyway, and I like the band, is that song by Depeche Mode, Enjoy the Silence, where words are meaningless and forgettable, they can only do harm. I mean, other than, like, making money and, like, you know, telling this and that, and, of course, you know, I understand the irony of us talking right now. I mean, I know you're sitting there stone thinking, yeah, but anyway, but that's true, though. That's why that's another reason that I love music, because you're basically, impart to people experiences, even though you're not going to get the same subjective reaction or even impression from it. There's a chance that you know what I mean? Like, most people would find that fast music that's minor is aggressive. Slow music that's kind of like, you know, it's got a pop to it and a backbeat and it's major, it's happy.
Right.
So, I mean, there are approximations in where people will see music as, you know, kind of like a center point of reference.
Do you ever think that music affects the consciousness field, affects all matter in certain ways, affects the actual orientation of molecules at an atomic level?
Well, the sound waves do.
Yeah.
But I mean, how do you mean exactly?
I mean, if the human being is mostly water and you're absorbing this sort of tonal frequency, your brain, your actual consciousness field is altered by certain tones. Like what you were saying, minor chords are associated with sort of a negative...
Well, that's in Western civilization.
Right.
If you go into Eastern civilization and you look, I'm not even Eastern, but Near Eastern, like, you know, Iraq, Iran, the Arabic scales, everybody knows, you know, how it's kind of like it sounds haunting or foreboding or like evil almost.
Right.
To them, I don't know what it sounds like to them, to be perfectly honest. But I can't imagine that they have the same kind of reaction or they get the same sort of impression from their traditional music that we get from their traditional music. Now, if you listen to Irish music, it's pentatonic. It's, you know, lots of major chords. I mean, it's like, even though they're lamenting their existence, and the Irish, of all people, have very much to lament about because of the fucking English. I like the English, don't get me wrong, but they're bastards. Anyway, but it's major, though, which is kind of weird. But in nowadays, though, like I said, that's pretty much the dichotomy. Like, major equals happy, minor equals sad. And if you look back, Plato and Aristotle talked about the different modes. And I don't know, I'm not that familiar with the modes. I'm kind of like illiterate when it comes to music. I know a few things here and there, but like for the most part, you know, I don't know much. But I know that they attributed different impressions or, I don't know, values or even characteristics to the different modes. So, and Nietzsche talks about this. I forget exactly where, but he says that music is a language, and whatever you're conditioned to as a young person is the way that you're going to view it. And if you can master a specific type of music, like a cultural type of music, it's like mastering a new language. So, like when you play the blues, you're mastering that Scots-Irish slave, you know, black slave Delta blues kind of like ideal. You speak their language. Or if you master Bach, that's the Germanic classical ideal or language, musical language. Or, you know, Balinese gamelan music. You know, I can go on and on, but you get the point.
Well, we'll get back to your personal initiative and how you've sort of given yourself this six-month deadline due date to get everything that's been in your head over the last 28 years.
Oh, no, it's not everything that's been in my head. It's only the what I think is ready.
Okay, well, the music that you think is ready, you're giving yourself this, like, very finite deadline to take all this musical equipment, which your father's going to help you finance, and you're planning on selling after the album's created.
Yeah.
I mean, you've been known to procrastinate, just like I have.
And I'm the worst of the worst.
Many people that are like, autistic and borderline, almost imitators of schizophrenic ways of thinking like we have, that we share, find it really hard to work any kind of normal job or to put ourselves in, not hard, and fucking impossible.
Yeah, so, I'd much rather put a bullet in my head than do a 9-to-5 job. And that's literal. I'm not, like, fucking exaggerating. That's not hyperbole.
So it's like, it's almost like we're stuck wandering these dead-end streets because we know what we want to do. We have the ability and talent to do it, yet we get apathetic about the pragmatic approach on how to physically get the fucking job done, because we're
true?
More, huh?
No, that's the fucking truth. I'm sorry. Yeah. Real quick, that's a really good fucking point. The magic of when you first write a piece of music is like again, you get the feeling of transcendence or epiphany. And then you go through the mechanical and banal motions and you have to think about, all right, technically, how am I going to put this down into a medium that's going to be distributed and, you know, played back. So that, it takes a lot of the magic out of it, and it kind of taints it, and I can understand that's, like, you know, why a lot of people end up hating their own music, not only because they have to play it every night, but also because, I think it was, like, Fenris from Darkthrone was one time talking about this album he recorded, and he was like, yeah, I'm not thinking about the music that I was recording at the time, I was thinking about the burger joint that I stopped at on the way to the studio. And that's a very fucking good way of illustrating what you just said.
You know, I think that's why we've been so close and have been such good friends with Bill all these years, is because he complimented us by being a little bit more industrious as far as being able to actually get what he has in his head onto some kind of recordable medium and do it pretty close to what he sees in his head. And I think that maybe our friendship was, in a lot of ways, just balanced with his presence. And since he's moved away, it's been harder and harder to get that actualized. He almost made it like a very simple, fluid motion, just being around to get those kind of things done.
There are a few people as charismatic. He's a left-handed person, just like Hitler, just like Jimi Hendrix, like Robert Fripp from King Crimson.
Mm-hmm.
He's, who else is left-handed who's, you know, real charismatic? Tons of fucking people. I think, I think, Leonardo da Vinci was left-handed. Left-handed people tend to... There's a correlation between left-handed people and homosexuality, but that's just an aside. And Bill definitely is not a homosexual. He's the most heterosexual person I've ever met.
Yeah.
But there's also a correlation, I think, what I've noticed, between left-handed people and charisma, which would make sense because that means the right side of their brain is dominant. And that's the... Yeah, the divergent thinking, as opposed to the convergent thinking, which is the left part of the brain. And that's where I have trouble. I'm very good at analyzing the shit out of things. I'm the kind of person you would say that has a lot of common sense, maybe a little too much. Although, at the same time, Einstein said that common sense is nothing more than prejudices that one's accumulated by the age of 18. Yeah, I half agree with him. But divergent thinking, which I think you excel at even more than I do, is the ability to look at things without really giving a shit about what anybody else has said about it. Like, looking at the possibilities rather than the actuality. Whereas, I look at the actuality and I look at the worst parts of it. Which is, you know, ties into my pessimism.
You do have an external, you know, source of pessimism, but you seem to be hiding, at least socially, a side that's a lot more emotionally rooted. Like there seems to be a deep caring. You said that you were like a master at pretending and masking your true emotions or your true feelings.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there's obvious connections that you have to people that are a little bit more substantial than your pessimism would imply. Like, to me, to your brother, even to your dog, Seamus. Like, I was looking at a picture of an old family portrait of you, like, holding Seamus, and the kind of bond you must have had with that dog when you were little is probably similar to the one that I have with my miniature pincher Bullet. And, you know, he's in the end of his years right now. Mm-hmm. He might be put down this year, and you don't really show a lot of those emotions, but I'm sure you're rooted, you know, and you have that deep feeling for other people. And you always say the only reason that you're around is because you want to make music, you want to produce these albums, and if you didn't have that, you would put a bullet in your brain. Mm. And if that wasn't the case, you'd put a bullet in your brain only for other people. Only for the people. You wouldn't want to make your mother or your brother or anyone around
you. Well, that's the reason I wouldn't put the bullet in my head.
Right.
Yeah.
So I guess the question is... for some reason, whatever you record in the next 6 months isn't what you envision in your head due to lack of industriousness, due to lack of equipment, due to lack of circumstance or will or whatever. What do you think that you're going to do? Because I don't feel that you're one to talk about it quite a bit, but I don't think that you would actually go through the suicide motion. So what do you envision if you had to honestly look at your life without embellishing at all? What would it be for you without the music?
Well, like you said, suicide is not an option for me because, you know, I'm going to be a douchebag martyr, just the way it is. I don't want to put the people who care about me in the same sort of pain that I feel every day and, you know, woe is me, whatever. I don't give a fuck. I don't need anybody's sympathy. I know for a fact that I fucking suffer. If everybody else suffers, if every person in the world suffers, well, then that sucks for you. It sucks for me.
But at the same note, though, there's a really serious truth to what we're talking about. How the sort of oddest mentality and the people that are just kind of visionary with their creative processes find it basically impossible to live what the consensus agreement is of a normal life, working a 9-to-5 job, sitting in the same fucking room all day in front of a computer, answering phones, doing customer service. If we can't do any of that, the only people that I know in my life that have avoided that sort of finality is the ones that either find people that are willing to support them completely financially, like their wives or their parents or whatever, or people that live in sort of small farming organic communities where they can live very minimally, not have very many bills, and sort of live on the farm and just and eat and, you know, like what Ezra does. It's sort of like a wolf farms where he's picking and eating the food he does, he consumes every day, and it's just like right there in nature. Very minimal time spent where he has to be focusing his mental capacities on things that are horrendous, you know, like office type clock in, clock out scenarios. So is that a life you could envision living yourself? Maybe not in America, maybe in Europe or something like that. Without music, without anything that belongs to Justin, could you surrender everything that you feel that needs to be expressed, or like this musical shit that you need to take, for a simpler lifestyle, almost monk-like, where you're just in nature, connected to nature, and not, you know, having any expectations on the self other than to just be your beingness?
That's my goal. Unfortunately, I have obsessions. I'm a very obsessive person. So, let's put it this way. If I were able to rewrite the software that's in my brain, I would rewrite it to where it's perfectly attuned to being able to survive in the wilderness pre-civilization. I think civilization is a fucking curse, okay? I forget what the guy's name was. Zerzan is his last name. He's a little kooky, but everybody who's read Apocalypse, the first Apocalypse culture, knows I think it's the demon engine of civilization. I mean, I couldn't fucking agree more. I think civilization is a curse. I think it's fucking stupid. He's also did another one called The Case Against Art. And the only reason that people create art is because they lost that natural ability to live in the moment. And they're obsessed with abstractions and all sorts of... I don't know, we would say, like, consensus points of reference. You know, people putting importance into things because, I mean, you know, you put importance into something because so many other people do, which is like religion or sports, you know. I mean, take into consideration, how many people give a shit about a bunch of guys getting together in a random field throwing a football? Nobody. Do a lot of people give a shit about the Super Bowl? Yeah. Why? Because a lot of people give a shit about the Super Bowl. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. I do see what you're saying.
And also, what you to backtrack a little bit, the the chasm between these epiphanic feelings that I get from music, or just the inhuman, transcending-like feelings that I get, so contrast with the banal minutia of what you have to go through in order to work a 9-to-5 job, which takes very little intelligence. And because I can go through it like simply rote actions, my brain and muscle memory basically kind of like the lower body takes over, and my neocortex is thinking about how much I suck and how much my life sucks and how boring this is and how I'd much fucking rather be doing anything else. And, or, you know, thinking about that great time when, you know, I was in the fucking woods and, like I said, it was cold out and I was listening to Mayhem. And, you know, I thought I was fucking the son of God. So the contrast between those two points is huge, and that's very important. That has to be taken into consideration.
I gotta take a piss. Well, just to give people a little background reference, we've known each other for what now? 12 years?
Not that long. January of 1998. No, 99.
Right. And we just had a real good musical synergy, like, real early on, whether we were doing...
Well, it was kind of stupid. He came in, he had a bottle of wine, because our mutual friend Bill was turning 17, so he came in, and then Bill was, like, saying, like, all right, so this is a prospective guitarist for the band that we were in at the time, which was Black Winter Z, black metal style. And I said, do you like Emperor? And Steve said that was an affirmative, so I was like, "All right, that's the sole criterion in which I want somebody in the, you know, to judge somebody, you know, to be able to be in the band."
I didn't even know how to tremolo pick that style of guitar playing at all. So,
yeah, I will say that the first song he came up with was fucking retarded.
It was really,
but,
really bad. What I did was,
but later on though, he fucking took off. But anyway.
What I did was I just took a CD that Bill lent me overnight, and Bill's the kind of guy that was like listening to death metal when we were listening to, or when I was listening to like Pearl Jam, and it was like he was the most intimidating middle schooler ever because he was just like wearing Cannibal Corpse shirts, and then he was getting into satanic like black metal. And
Bill has been basically a 30-year-old guy since the time he was like I've known him.
Yeah,
like he's much older than he is.
Yeah, I don't know how that happened.
Legendary guy.
He skipped ahead early on, so he became an influence in my life, both of our lives.
Oh, fucking huge, man. Early. I'd be a completely different person if it weren't for the shit he turned me on to.
Yeah, so when I was listening to that, or started listening to Metallica, and he was giving me, like, Emperor, and, you know, what other bands was he giving me? Dissection, Mayhem, that kind of thing. I would just take home the CDs in particular. I took
Dark
home.
Throne.
Yeah,
can't
I took home.
Fucking Dark
Throne. That came a little bit later, but
yeah,
I took home Anthems of the Walking at Dusk, and I just listened to the whole CD and I was like, this is fucking impossible. It sounded like, you know, it sounded like Beethoven, Bach, some symphony just played with a guitar. So I had to teach myself how to tremolo pick like that basically overnight, and I did a horrible job for the tryout. But I guess Bill and Justin...
That wasn't a try. You were already in the band.
I guess I was already in the band. It was just, it was a matter of convenience just because there weren't a whole lot of backup black metalers back then.
Not a lot.
But we got along, too, which was more important. We had the same kind of dark humor and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, I don't know, we wrote lots of really good music, and we only released one demo. We played a few shows around Fort Lauderdale Culture Room, some parties and things like that. And Yoko Ono came into our lives, and Bill found a girlfriend who was really, really serious that he eventually had a...
Well,
no,
it was a little more than Yoko Ono. Also, a Sean Lennon arrived, so...
Yeah. Right. Well, so that happened, and he was, I guess, he still seemed really interested in the band, but Justin and I were taking more key roles in the writing process, and he was starting to get pissed off and felt like he couldn't compete, or...
Well, no, what I remember, no, What I remember is we diverged. I mean, I don't know how fucking detailed you want to get into this.
Go ahead. Honesty is all I'm looking for.
We were more like, he was more purist. Actually, he had a fucking vision from the very beginning. And to be honest, in its embryonic form, I wasn't impressed at all. Basically, he used a lot of minor chords the way that, like, Bathory would use power chords. He used minor chords, like full fucking barred minor chords. And the way he used it was a little... It sounded too, like, sentimental and, like, wishy-washy. But something along the line, like, obviously, he just got better and better. He understood what he... Like, exactly what he wanted to do. He pinpointed it. And then he came out with, like... I would say definitely the most extreme black metal album I've ever heard. And it's called... It's by the band In Curses.
It's In Curses, and the album is what it's called, Eternal Funeral Trance, right?
No.
No, that's a song.
That's the demo. I don't even know what the album is called. I have no fucking
that's
idea.
That's how good friends we are, but it's an incredible freaking
album.
Well,
I have a fucking burned copy of it, so
right.
It doesn't say it on there.
What I was going to say, it was less of competing, like less of him not writing riffs off the par, and more just having to do with three people who were intelligent and musically writing together that were just butting heads and differing on the path the band was going to go on. And then we were approaching the college years, and Bill's parents are like super supportive people, and I think that they pretty much edged him, irked him along, and gave him money so he would go to University of Central Florida. And when he left, Justin and I still jammed for a while, but it was like that when the Trinity dispersed, it kind of really separated. Because we had a drummer that's also Justin's cousin, his name is Corey, that the foursome kind of broke up at that point, and we never really congealed or found...
But it's really all about the fucking threesome.
Yes.
And Bill has become, since then, he's become a really good drummer. So basically, if that were to be the case, like he were to develop his skill the way he has now, and we were to stay together, we'd have been the greatest fucking band in the world. But
yes.
Life doesn't give you what you want.
Yeah, exactly. And
and
you
that's
know,
kind of and by giving myself an ultimatum to release this album within 6 months, it's kind of a gay way of making up for that. Also, I want to say that though, if any of you are influenced or interested by Robert Fripp from King Crimson, that there's a really good interview you can get on YouTube by these two idiots in the late 70s, Buffamundo, the show was called. But anyway, even tedious as he speaks, Robert Fripp imparts a lot of great fucking information about the way an intelligent person who appreciates music down to its very core could possibly do. He goes very in-depth into his psychology, and it's probably one of the most enlightening interviews ever. But if you're the kind of person who has, short attention span, don't bother.
So, I guess in summation, there were periods of time where, I also went to the University of Central Florida, but we all, like I said, dispersed at that time. I eventually ended up moving back in with Bill in Atlanta and playing and touring in Demon Sea and also helping with his project In Curses and working on my own band called Vixis Occultus at the time. And, basically just spending countless hours in a military-style environment, living in a very small living quarters with no air conditioning in the summertime, playing drums like 2 or 3 hours a day. I view it as a martial activity. I would play guitar until, my fingers were raw, and I was just trying to hone my talents to the point where it was a very distinguished, easily identifiable new kind of sound. And I got to that point, but in the way that kind of black metal works these days is you play musical chairs with everybody. Everybody kind of helps out with each other's projects. And my band, Vixis, was sort of, even though it was really good, the music was really good, got pushed in the back burner just because of tours and other people trying to get recordings completed. Because sometimes, people in these circles are such perfectionists that a single album could take years and years and years to be, up to par to where they want to release it. So I was basically helping everybody do that. And I lost interest in pursuing my band after a while because I realized that I could do other creative things like video editing or... Just other things that were just mine that I didn't have to rely on other people to complete it, and it's degraded into that point. I moved back to Florida, and Justin and I started jamming in with Corey, but I was in severe amounts of jaw pain. We were doing like a psychedelic project at that point. We switched from metal to psychedelic, and a lot of it was really good as well. A lot of our little side projects were excellent, But I was in like traumatic amount of jaw pain. I'm still in an incredible amount of jaw pain. Became addicted to opiates. I got a serious double jaw surgery in Costa Rica, which I still haven't recovered from. I have nerve damage in my face. And so music for me, I had to sort of let loose the reins and relinquish a lot of that and surrender all that that musical shit that Justin's trying to take. I had to take that shit without actually recording. And I'm afraid that he feels that I sort of abandoned him in a lot of ways, because we were writing together so often and frequently. We had such a cohesion that's just rare with two musicians playing. But I can't force it. I can't pretend that I derive as much pleasure from writing music anymore as he does. You know, unfortunately, there's like this constriction I put on myself where I don't feel, as a musician, after you get into your 30s and 40s and, you know, onwards, that you're as inspired or as capable of writing the same kind of things that you were, you know, when you were in your teens and 20s. And I feel like I'm getting older, and it's just more difficult for me to get in that mind state where I could write those kind of riffs that I feel are brilliant and worthy of being recorded. And at the same time, I still play guitar, and I still have those incredible epiphanies and sort of kundalini rising experiences with just riffs that I play on my own private time. But he set this sort of goal for himself that maybe in the back of his mind he thought I was going to be able to help a lot more with, as far as the songwriting, as far as just being a team with this and finding a drummer and getting the band together again. And I'm sort of on the opposite end of the spectrum right now, very chaotic. I want to sell all of my possessions and just travel the world and, you know, disappear into smaller communities. And we're on two different paths, and I don't know. I worry sometimes that Justin feels that I abandoned him. So I don't know. What do you think about that?
There's only one thing I could possibly agree with on that whole monologue, and that would be the idea that as you get older, you get less inspired. That is absolutely true. When you're 27 years old, your brain, physiologically, is not quite as good as visuospatial reasoning. And visuospatial reasoning is directly tied in with being able to produce music as far as the rhythm, or maybe in certain elements, the harmony is concerned. So that I do have concerns about, and that's kind of like why I give myself an ultimatum. But at the same time, I'm a very immature person. I have a lot of hate, and I believe that more than anything in this world, hate keeps you young. And I hate a lot. I hate the world, which means that I hate myself.
Hunter Thompson comes to mind.
Yeah, no, but I know that I'm my own worst enemy. And I think that the fact that I do hate myself in the context of art is such an asset. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, like, if you want to talk about fucking people who aren't talented in their 30s, all I gotta say is, let's see, well, fucking King Crimson, yes, Typo Negative, man, there's so many fucking, Morbid Angel, yeah. Jesus Christ.
So many.
I don't have to go on, I'm not gonna do this, it's belaboring the point. And also, as far as you abandoning me, like, fuck yeah, I would rather you hang out and, like, you know, jam with me. I totally fucking enjoy that, that's great. But, you have no fucking obligation. Are you crazy?
I feel like I do sometimes.
No, that's ridiculous.
Because you make it seem like Absolutely this music not. Thing, if it doesn't happen, it's like, what the fuck next?
That's my fucking problem, dude.
And I agree with you. I mean,
that's for me to deal with. That's my... Dude, let me tell you something.
That's the crux of this kind of conversation, though. What do people like
Hang
us
on,
fucking
one
do
second.
In reality if we're not creating some kind of art? What do we do? How do we sustain ourselves? How, there's a lot of us. I mean, not a lot of us, but there's a lot of us out there that are dealing with these same kind of struggles, and they basically launch themselves into abstractions. A lot of people that listen to Labyrinth and Psychonaut videos are very, very paranoid people, you know, very frightened about the big, you know, Big Brother, the big picture, you know, BP oil spill is going to fucking flood the entire planet, they're going to evacuate Florida and turn Florida into like a FEMA death camp and that kind of thing. You got all these just bizarre happenings all over the world that appear, you know, anywhere from the line of fringe science to just the damn, you know, unbelievable sightings and scientific breakthroughs and meshings of consciousness that we have never seen before. In synchronistic circles, where we're basically people are getting all on the same page non-locally, and making a montage of you know, all these conspiracy theories and just the way that the world seems to be heading. And I don't know, I often wonder what you think the future holds as far as, because in the chaos seems to be skyrocketing, yet nature could never not be okay. It's sort of like an external reflection of what's going on internal. If there's a lot of shit internally that we're holding, you know, if we're not being truly honest with ourselves, and we have a lot of sort of inner turmoil, we kind of reflect that onto society and the world, and that kind of reaps paranoia, and it makes these sort of sweeping statements in your psyche that is doom and gloom oriented. And I wonder what you think about, like, just current events and what things.
Sure.
Go ahead.
As a general trend, I would say, in the Islamic world, there will be a very violent. It'll reach a crescendo within, I don't know how many years. I'm not going to put a fucking amount of years on it, but whatever. Isn't that ironic? I'm putting amount of time on myself, but not on... Anyway.
There you go.
I have control over that. Shut up.
All right.
All right. But anyway, like in the Islamic world or the really religious world, they're not basically the non-Western world where people are actually like have fucking, you know, means to... What do they call them? Industrial world? Industrialized countries? Second and first...
Sure.
Level countries or first world countries that will continue. I think the trend is going to swing back toward corporatism and not so much liberalism, though. The libertarian ideal looks cute, Rand and Ron Paul and all that looks like a real good, jolly good time, but yeah, not gonna happen because the vast majority of people don't have enough fucking balls to keep. Their independence the way it was in the late 19th century when the executive branch of government had very little power. It was real nice. Notice none of those presidents are noteworthy for a fucking thing, and there's a reason for that, because they had no power. And think about it, that was one of the most progressive eras in this country.
Yeah, that's true. A president's only in office for 8 years max. I mean, what kind of power can they give these sort of puppet representatives anyway, you know?
But taking into consideration that the United States is now the big dog on the porch, you know, England, you know, got their ass kicked in World War II, even though supposedly they won, but they lost their fucking empire. So who really won that? The United States is now the superpower, we're the sole superpower, blah, blah, blah. We're the fucking canary in the cage is really what it is. And, things are going to change. This country is not going to, like, turn into a shithole like everybody's, like, saying. You know, they're saying, like, it's going to be, you know, fucking bedlam, which is ridiculous. This country is still going to be on top relative to the vast majority of countries in the world. The difference is going to be that you're going to have a lot more balkanization. Sorry to use a cliche of people. You're going to have people of ideals clinging together more, I think. And that's because a large part of the internet is large in part because of the internet.
What do you think about the internet?
I think it's a great thing. I think it's more of a... because of chaos, I believe in chaos over order. My motto is, divided we stand, united we fall. World War II would never have occurred, and that's the greatest disaster the world's ever seen, would never have occurred were it not for a bunch of humans cooperating with each other on any side, whether Axis or ally.
Mm-hmm.
What single person could do that much damage? None. The greatest death toll for a fucking killing spree was by some Korean guy. Apparently Koreans are good at, like, you know, spree killings, like just like VTech. But this guy was in Korea proper, and he was the fucking captain of some prefecture or some bullshit. He had access to military grade weaponry. He had grenades. He had automatic assault rifles. This and that and the other. I think it was like 47. He eventually chalked up, or maybe 50 something. Compared to World War II, what the fuck is that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, what the fuck is that? Like, if the situation in Israel keeps fucking mounting to the point where they want to reenact this Revelations doomsday scenario where that area of the world constantly houses war and violence and pent-up frustration over whether it's religion or, you know, other United States helping one faction versus the other and making this sort of, like, contrived drama of chess pieces, if that's not fucking enacted finally... I mean, it seems like for decades and decades and even hundreds of years that people, and it's been pressing for this, like, I think Albert Pike wrote, the famous Mason, he actually, like, had a portent writing of the future, what he felt like the three world wars would do and would set out to do, and actually which factions would be involved, like to basically benefit the Zionists or the Khazars, whoever the fuck is in control of the puppeteers, whatnot.
The Khazar theory.
And it seems right now that things are escalating again. I mean, even to the point of, like, I don't want to say no return, but to the point of fulfilling this drama. So, I mean, if this World War III scenario enacts on top of this, you know, incredible ecological disaster that many people are saying could have been set off on purpose or contrived as well, because a lot of the stockholders in BP and whatnot got rid of their stocks a couple weeks before the rig exploded. And then that basically was linked to Cheney and Halliburton as well. And there's a lot of symbolic things happening now as well. Like the rig that was secondary or closer to the one that exploded was called the Atlantis. So, you know, a lot of people think that the powers that be orchestrate these things as gigantic dramas, the world being the stage and whatnot, and that there's, you know, chess masters that have many, many moves ahead of us that are seeing these things unfold in their heads on documents and plans and meetings and Bilderberg fucking get-togethers decades before they're actually enacted. And they mimic and mirror things like 9/11. You know, this particular event, like I was talking about, was correlated to Arthur C. Clarke's 2001 being released. Like, I know I made a comment on my Facebook, and you kind of poked fun at it. But, you know, in sacred mysticism, we look at things symbolically. So what I was saying is that the 2001 Arthur C. Clarke was released, and in that year 9/11 happened, and the towers were sitting flush with the Millennium Hilton building, which is basically designed, the architect admits that it was designed to be like the Black Monolith in 2001, and the Black Monolith was like a Stargate because it symbolized human beings going from one point in their evolution to the next point, whatever that may be, an ascension point where they're learning space travel or, you know, faster than light speed travel, etc., and, you know, different epochs in human evolution, that kind of thing. And then the next movie just happens to be 2010, the year we make contact. It's very ambiguous. Lots of people are going to say, you know, what the hell does that mean? Make contact with what? Ourselves, ETs, you know, make contact. What is that implying exactly? Well, and then we have these catastrophes that are mirroring the 9/11 event in many ways, because some of the same companies that were involved with getting super rich off the 9/11 towers coming down are getting super rich again, and linking back to the same people like Halliburton and Cheney with this BP water rig going down. And there's even silly things like that movie Knowing with Nicolas Cage. There's a scene where he's sitting on the couch and he's watching the news. The whole movie's about how basically his daughter, his son, unearths this time capsule that is encoded in a way that it tells future catastrophes that are going to happen. And the basic idea of the movie is that extraterrestrials, you know, set a timeline of things that were going to happen because they could see in our two-dimensional time what was going to happen. And one of the things that Cage was watching on the news was that there was a gigantic deep water ocean oil explosion that was out of control, and it was spilling buckets of pollutants into the Gulf. And that movie came out, I think, like a year and a half or 2 years before this oil thing exploded. And again, I'm not saying that this is like tangibly set up like this and it's literal. I'm saying in sacred mysticism we look at things symbolically. So do you ever see these things as sort of like an ornate drama that could actually be a part of collective consciousness, or just something that's interwoven in the fabric of this hologram, if it were like a Matrix environment?
I have what I'm very I mean, in the way that Carl Jung has described synchronicity, I'm really very familiar with the concept, and I'm really very familiar with the experience. It's happened so many times now that it's almost mundane to me. Now, that sounds fucking jaded and, you know, smarmy. But in reality, what I'm saying is, like, first of all, probability is so fucking great that the greatest coincidence is that there are no coincidences. Second, the human mind is going to find associations in a myriad ways. There's so many different characteristics about any given concept that, you know, eventually you're going to find a fucking commonality somewhere. And if you find, two commonalities in something that maybe suggests a certain thrust or a contrivance on the part of the powers that be, it's really compelling to believe in that. But the thing is, because, like I said, I give the most credence to the probability theory that, you know, probability has more to do with the world than any sort of
Another example, people that see like the 11/11s everywhere and certain numbers over and over again. I know, but in reality, what you really believe is that they're just seeing something symmetrical or something that they have given worth to in their own conscious mind.
Exactly.
So if they're like 11/11 is an important date because it's the end of the Mayan calendar, then all of a sudden they're going to start seeing 11/11 more often.
Precise.
Or if they're looking to buy like a blue Dodge Magnum, all of a sudden they're going to see more blue Dodge Magnums on the road. It's not that they weren't there before, it's just that they're more alert to those kind of things.
Yep.
But, I mean, in two-dimensional time...
But the question is, though, what does it mean?
Yeah.
Ultimately.
It's the meaning, it's the syntax, exactly. And
like, does it mean anything beyond the fact that you're noticing 11/11 more? Or does 11/11 point to...
I think that it's calling attention to the fact that there are precursors, that there's providence, that there are things written into the code of this reality that are predetermined. It's predeterminism. And it a lot of people feel enslaved by that when they get that sensation because... they feel like they're no longer in control of their actions, that their fate is more or less set in stone, and that if time were like a river, they could basically chuck stones or sticks into the river's direction, but ultimately that river's going to go in the same...
Well, your fate is set in stone because you only have one. You can't go through a permutation of fates, so...
Well, I'm saying if there was a being out there that had your entire life...
I understand exactly
life,
what
right.
you're saying. Okay. You're saying like... the Archon, or maybe even like the ultimate being. The
doesn't
ultimate,
even have to be the ultimate being, just a being
whatever.
That's more advanced than human.
They set the course.
Yeah.
It's all contrived by them. Everything is predetermined. You have no free will. Well, I don't believe in free will. The reason that I believe in, or don't believe in free will, is actually different than the reason that what Steve is talking about right now. I don't know if that's exactly what he thinks. But,
actually, I
don't know. I don't think it's, well, one second. I don't think it's a narrative. I think that free will is basically an illusion that is granted upon any sort of animal in order to give them, it's hard to explain, but to give them the vast variety of actions that they could possibly take. So in order for an advanced organism to be the way it is, sort of like a computer, without taking commands from an outside source, it takes commands of its own accord. It's a very, it's almost like a virus in a way. It's basically a virus.
I think what I'm getting at, like the core issue, is we've had, you know, very, very interesting, lengthy, hour-long conversations about what I call the trickster god scenario. And it's basically like, we play off each other because I seem to be more optimistic about things with spirit and ascension potential in human beings. Like, I see the good in them. And we were talking earlier about extreme left-hand path, extreme right-hand path, but also the middle path. And I was wondering, like, if you could... I mean, because I've never seen you more distraught mentally. Not even about this music thing. Even if you never write another song in your lifetime, record an album or whatever, I've never seen you more distraught than when you talk about this trickster god and what happened to you on New Year's in 2000 and sort of... Someone, a puppeteer.
I don't want to go into detail about that because I'm a paranoid person and
right.
I don't want people manipulating me.
Well, who's going to manipulate you?
I don't know, man. Like I said, I'm fucking paranoid. Probably the same reason that this, I had this experience. But yeah, on the year 2000, even though I wasn't aware of Gnosticism, even as much as I read, I wasn't aware of Gnosticism at the age of 18, I guess, or 17, whatever. Yeah, New Year's would be...
You hadn't heard the term Gnosticism?
I didn't understand the concept.
Okay.
I mean, I've heard about it, but I didn't understand the concept. I know the Dead Sea Scrolls, but I never read the shit, you know?
Right.
So basically, I had the idea of an Archon in my head. Basically, this is the generative force, a personified generative force, a being that is more aware than I, more powerful than I, and is contriving the entire world that controls every single person, and every single person is simply an automaton of his will, simultaneously. Taking into consideration that I'm such a simple creature in comparison to him, it'd be a simple feat for him to do that. I asked him for a sign. And, like, on New Year's, I remember seeing 1234 over and over again, 1, 2, 3, 4, which, again, has, like, you know, it's a sequence, and that has meaning in the minds of humans, if you have any mathematical awareness. So I basically asked to see that, And it was weird because we went over to our friend's house. We walked across the entire development. And as soon as we got in there, I looked up at the clock, and sure enough, what time was it?
Couldn't that have been a symptom of exactly basically, what we're talking about?
What I'm saying is a part of my brain flew out the window. But I got to go back to what I said. And if you've ever read Immanuel Kant or, you know, I know you read Schopenhauer, but Critique of Pure Reason, you'll understand now why that doesn't give me the anxiety, nor does it interest me the way that it used to.
That it did when you were
because
younger.
It's fucking meaningless. Yeah. Everybody is the same thing. The only thing is you have different impressions. It's hard to get over because everybody has an ego, and that's what the middle path is about. It's about being active. It's about maintaining a discipline, being a force, a phenomenological force in the universe, but at the same time not having so much investment in it that the true will of the entire, you know, manifestation, the physical manifestation, phenomenological manifestation of your being, the Kia, is not thwarted by egoistic and in other words, provincial obsessions, of which I partake. But at the same time, because of my excessive use of psychedelics and because of my voracious obsessiveness on metaphysics, it kind of actually counteracts any kind of provincial thinking in a lot of ways, even though in specific ways I've got a fucking lot to learn, you know. But like in other ways, I'm pretty fucking far out there, man.
Well, that's a good summation, definitely. I'm glad that we got to talking about this, for sure, because we've lost just hours and hours of these kind of conversations that we've had in the past about, you know, left-hand path, right-hand path, conspiracy theories, paranoid awareness, that kind of thing. I guess the only question I have left is, you know, what would you suggest to people who are dealing with the same things that we're dealing as sort of borderline, if not full-blown, autists that have a hard time coping with day-to-day reality and flock to, you know, paranoid situations and articles and delusions of grandeur and fantasy and, you know, exploding the ego and getting out of a more honest moment and, you know, in order to make ourselves feel better temporarily. And I guess, what are you going to do? What are you going to do without embellishing or, you know, what are you going to do?
I have no idea. You want me to be literal? I have no fucking idea.
That's a good answer. I guess people...
I was going to say lobotomy or suicide, but...
Lobotomy or suicide. There's no upturn, there's no window where you feel like you can be...
Oh, no, it's possible, just not probable. Remember that? Remember that term? That rose a few times.
Exactly. You know, there's no reason to end on a high note with a podcast. Fuck that shit. You know, if you guys are bummed out by this, it's the reality of a lot of people's daily lives. It's just mental suffering and agony. And, you know, returning to lifelong crutches and imbalances and psychological traumas that stem from, you know, familial trauma, you know, trauma that you've had in your love life, with drugs that you've taken, with your failures and everything else. And by the time you're in your Saturn return, when you're approaching 30, a lot of times there's so much harm and negative things done, you feel... that you've let yourself down more than anything. It's a very crucial point in one's life, whether to keep on trucking when you have this kind of mentality or to take the Hunter S. Thompson route out of here. It's maybe a little pessimistic, but it's sometimes the most real thing that you can possibly talk about.
I got nothing to add to that.
All right.